You can kill your business by holding on too tightly. The business would die without me. I'm holding my company back. I don't need to be the smartest person in the room.
Welcome back to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Holman, and I'm really glad to be here with you right now talking to Raoul West. Raoul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's good to have you. We're just kicking off our advisory insights episodes, and you get to be one of the first people to do that, where we talk to smart people who help advise and support CEOs as they're growing their businesses. So thanks for bringing that perspective.
Wonderful. Well, I'm happy to. Yeah. Well, I was a CEO for many, many years. In fact, I've been a serial entrepreneur for 45 years.
Oh, so fantastic.
It's only been in the last 2 or 3 years that I've transitioned into a coaching role. So, I've got a lot different perspective on it than a lot of coaches because of the fact that I wore those boots and slogged through that mud myself.
I love that. That seems to be a common path for some people. They've been down that path once, twice, many times, and then they say, "Hey, I think I can actually maybe leverage what I've done broader." Is that the drive to become a coach after being a CEO so many times?
Yes, it really is born from a passion. For one, I love to teach. I love to learn, first of all, and then I love to teach. And it just came to my attention that so many entrepreneurs are just bogged down in the day-to-day operations. And in our business, we learned how to get out of the day-to-day activities so that we could let our team pretty much run the business. And we kept tabs on it from afar, like from our second home on Maui. And, you know, I think, gee, this is no way to live, being tied to the business like we were, you know, 24/7. And we were exhausted and we were not healthy and our family life suffered. And so I really want to help entrepreneurs learn how to run their business in a way that supports their life and, you know, have a thriving, successful, scaling business as well. And I know that I've got the experience, having done it myself, I can help them.
Yeah. Do you find that's, and we'll get into more of this misalignment, alignment discussion in a moment, but do you find that it's easy to convince entrepreneurs that it's time to make that change from, you know, entrepreneur-centric operations into something that is more scalable and more manageable because it's more, you know, because you do create some distance? Is that easy or is that a hard sell?
You would think it would be easy. It's like, gee, freedom to have the life I really want versus being a slave to my business. What's the choice? And too many times they say, oh, I can't let go. The business would die without me. I have to be there. I have to be at the helm. And I say, no, you don't. And I can show you how not to be. And they're like, And they don't believe me. And it's just very difficult for some to trust other people and, you know, to be able to let go and trust that things would run as smoothly as it would, you know, if they were right there in the seat managing everything. So it takes a little bit of mindset shifting in order to get the entrepreneur to realize that, oh, I'm holding my company back. I'm not allowing it to grow and scale because I'm trying to do everything myself.
You know, that's interesting as you say that. I was thinking back, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, because I built a law firm and it's small, but it's actually very scalable and manageable in the sense that we've built a team that can run it. I don't have to, you know, I can be doing a podcast today. I'm not tied to the billable hour 24/7. But I think back 4 or 5 years ago and I'm like, I remember having conversations with friends and other attorneys and I'd be like, hey, you should come on board. We could build something really cool. And the answer was always an enthusiastic yes. I just have to finish this project. And that would last, projects would come and go, but the same response was there for a year or 2 years. I'm like, whoa, okay, I'm not getting an answer that is, I don't know, authentic or whatever. Like they intended, but they just couldn't quite ever pull the trigger, if I can say it that way.
Yeah. Well, and what you've done by being able to bring a team on and free yourself up to get away from the, you know, exchanging time for money kind of idea is that you're using leverage. And that's one of the keys. And anybody who's clinging to, you know, what they're doing and, you know, their billable hours or, you know, whatever kind of business it is, sometimes it's not hours that you're selling,
right.
But you're not allowing your business to grow. You're not allowing yourself to thrive. And that's really the key. So you have to use leverage and you have to build a team. And you just said that you've got a team now, and that does give you more freedom.
Well, and so I guess maybe this does, I was thinking originally this was maybe a tangential conversation, but as we talk about team and I think about the theme of this conversation about some of the team members who have been founders, they have that, we often call it the owner mentality, right? And then they start to bring team members on to help supplement with the intention to grow and scale. Like, is that one of the reasons we see mismatch in executive leadership teams? Because the roles, although we call them all executive leaders, the roles fundamentally are kind of stay in the same mode that they were from founder versus non-founder?
I'm not sure if it's the role per se. I believe in the impact of a culture on an organization. And the culture has to stem from the leader, the founder or CEO or whoever it is that's leading the organization. And the culture has to allow for the team members to step up and do what they're best at doing. So the founder needs to establish frameworks and guidelines and boundaries. Way back when we were studying with Robert Kiyosaki in the 1980s and 90s, before he became famous for Rich Dad, Poor Dad,
yes,
that he taught us about a fruit bowl theory of business, where you've got a bowl that's made of, you know, wood, china, metal, whatever, and the shape of that bowl stays the same. And that's your boundary, that's your guidelines. But you have to allow the fruit to, you know, lay in that bowl however it wants to. You know, maybe you've got bananas, apples, oranges, grapes, pears, whatever. Yeah. And the fruit can be arranged in many different ways, and it's still a fruit bowl. But if the founder or the leader has too tight a constraint on the contents of that bowl, and they don't let their team members be a little bit about who they are, then they're grasping it too tightly. You know, just like that old adage about, you know, you hold a bird too tightly and it can't fly.
Or survive, maybe. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And to that point, you can kill your business by holding on too tightly and not allowing it to grow. The aspect of culture is that the leader has to establish those frameworks, those guidelines, set up boundaries. You know, these are the rules. These are my values. These are my principles. This is how I want the company to be perceived by the community, by our customers, and by our vendors. And you establish that culture first, and then you bring your team members on and you inculcate them into the culture and you sell them on the culture. Yeah. And what your goals and vision for the company are. And then you become a real forward-moving team. Another thing that we did with our team was we incentivized our team members. You know, we got them oriented to what it takes to make the company successful. And one of the things we did, I'm going to segue just a little bit off to the side, is that we read a book called The Great Game of Business by Jack Stack. Robert Kiyosaki recommended it to us. And we said, okay, cool. We bought it that day.
Yeah.
And Jack Stack was promoting the idea of open book management. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, what is that? You know, and he said, you know, you've got to share the financials with your team. So team needs to understand what it is that makes the company tick and, you know, what goes to the bottom line and, you know, where each of them can impact how the company does. So we started to share our financials with our team, but we had a very young team and many of them had never seen a P&L, didn't know what P&L
stood
for, balance sheet, what's that? So we held little classes and we taught them how to interpret financial statements. So once they grasped, oh, that's what happens when we spend this kind of money or if we don't watch our margins or any of those things, they really got it. So then they were able to be a lot more active partners with us. Yeah. We had empowered them to make better decisions. And we had a culture guidelines that were set up so that we said, okay, these are the values that we have. We called them our work ethic, W-E-R-Q, win-win, efficiency, responsibility, and quality. Okay. And we said, okay, if you use these principles to make decisions, like you're making a decision for one of our customers, we'll back you. We'll support your decision if you could say, I was doing this because it's a win-win. It was efficient. We took responsibility. We're delivering a quality product. Now, maybe we would disagree with their evaluation of that, but if so, we would just talk about it later. We wouldn't blast them or undermine their authority to make that decision. And what that did was empower the team to be able to deliver for our customers right there on the spot, instead of saying, oh, wait a minute, I have to go ask my supervisor or something. You know, that just slows everything down and customers get frustrated, and it's not a good system. So this idea of a culture, you know, again, it comes from the top, and you have to be very clear with your team about what you expect, what a good job looks like, what your parameters are, what you won't tolerate, you know, where everybody needs to be accountable and how you hold them accountable. And then they get in on the game, they're incentivized, they get a bonus if the company reaches its goals, and they see money in their pocket. You know, in some cases, our team members were able to make a down payment on a house with their bonus. You know, this was incredible. So this is how you get real alignment with your team and allows the company to scale. I mean, we scaled just exponentially.
Well, tell us how much you scaled. And then I have a question, because I want to dig into this. Okay. What did you scale? Where did you start? Was it a business you guys started from scratch?
Yes, it was a business that was started with nothing, zero sales, zero investment other than hard work. My husband actually started it, and then I joined him. And I had my own business at the time, and so we worked kind of side by side. And then eventually I basically stopped my business to go full-time in this one. Yeah. And what we were doing was we were selling vacations to Hawaii from Alaska. So we lived in Alaska, and Hawaii is the favorite vacation destination for Alaskans.
That makes sense, I think.
Very, very pale Alaskans in Hawaii. when we first started out, we were just packaging condos that my husband would represent Alaskans who owned condos over in Hawaii. Then we added rental cars and inter-island air. Then we added the Trans-Pacific air portion. Mm-hmm. And then one year, the scheduled carriers that we were working with decided not to fly between Alaska and Hawaii anymore. So we were like, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Our business dropped to nothing. And we almost had to close the doors. But my husband was incredibly ingenious and resourceful. He found a plane that we could charter. It was a DC-8. I won't go into all the details of that, but we had a summertime charter, which operated several flights, you know, 200 some passengers per plane. And we did our homework and figured out that we could afford to take that risk because we'd, you know, produced that much business in prior summers. So that led us into chartering more and bigger planes. So we ended up chartering wide body jets, 767s and so forth.
You're starting your own airline.
We did. We had basically it was called a scheduled charter airline. Uh-huh. And we operated it for 25 years. And we were the primary way that Alaskans got to Hawaii. And we grew from, as I said, nothing to being mid 8 digits in annual revenue. Wow. And then we sold the business to Alaska Airlines.
Wow, that's phenomenal. So we're not talking, I mean, not to discount smaller businesses, but this is real scale that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So these are real solutions that you implemented. My question is this, though, because I think about a lot of people that I've worked with, and I see them struggle. And I, as an attorney, I see behind the scenes, I know they feel like things are like maybe more difficult for them than for the other companies that, of course, all appear successful on the outside. What you've described so far for scaling and some of these tools and implementations, I think some of the people I've worked with would say to themselves, I get it. It makes sense, but I'm not sure how to jump from where I'm at stuck in my business, to just feel like I can get on the starting line and start to implement that stuff. Does that make sense that some people...
It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
I mean, it took us years to work our way out of our job of running a business. It took, you know, I think about 5 years from the time that we consciously said, okay, our goal is to get out of the day-to-day operation. It took 5 years. And we studied, you know, I went back to college. I mean, I got a degree in organizational management. You know, I studied total quality management, and we just implemented all kinds of things. In fact, my team would start to dread that I would come into the office after being in at my college class the night before, and I'd walk in and say, guess what we're going to try today? God, no. But, you know, so I forced change on them because I was learning about culture, and everything I learned, I used it in my little guinea pig called our business. We so tested theories out.
Is it that maybe the fear of what sounds so big keeps people from just taking the first step? Is that really the problem then?
Well, sure. If some people feel like they have to have it all perfectly outlined and planned
right
before they start. And I don't think you're going to get anywhere if you wait.
Hey, I have an engineering background and I know exactly how that feels. I'm like, listen, we're going to start, but I want to know where it's going first. And I want to know how it's going to finish and how I do that and make sure. And it's taken me a long time as a business owner to just get to the point where I'm like, wait a second. Starting is the key, not designing the outcome, right? Because we all know once you design the outcome and you actually start, the outcome's going to move on you. You're not going to end up exactly where you thought you were, and you're not going to follow the path you thought you were going to. So starting is really the only consistent thing is you start, and that remains consistent until it changes.
Yeah, Tony Robbins totally promotes the idea of just take action. You know, I have a massive action plan. Then I have another mentor who says, say it ugly first. You know, don't figure it all out until it's perfect. Just spit it out, say it ugly. And, you know, and then you'll get to work on it once you've spit it out. So you have to be willing to take that risk though. Another mentor, Jesse Itzler, says, you know, don't let the fear of embarrassing yourself stop you from taking action. You know, so many of us, me included, I don't say things or I don't do something because, I don't want to be humiliated. I don't want to be embarrassed. And so you hold back. And, you know, to be an entrepreneur, you have to be willing to take risks. And one of those risks is, let's try this. I don't know how it's going to work. It might be a total flop, but we're going to give it a go and we're going to keep working on it. And, you know, if we get to a certain point and we say, this just isn't the right path, then we'll pivot. We'll stop. We'll do something else. We did that several times.
You know? Yeah, that makes sense. And so when a CEO gets that courage to take that step, to say ugly to begin with and just get started, how will they know that their leadership team or, you know, husband, wife in your case or whatever it is, how will they know that they've got real alignment, real buy-in from the team to move forward? Because it's easy for a CEO to just say, we're going to do it. And that's kind of the way that they've always done it and why they're not scaling, because they just cram it down and they say, this is the way it is. There's not that buy-in. But how do you do it so that there's buy-in, and or am I focusing on the wrong thing here?
Well, I think it's simple, actually. Sounds complicated, but ask them.
Okay.
Ask them, what do you think about this idea?
Yeah.
Are you with me? Does this sound, are we ready to go for it? Are you with me?
You know, it's that easy.
It's as simple as that. It's like too many leaders of businesses think that they have to have all the answers and they have to tell their people what to do. No, not necessarily. I don't need to be the smartest person in the room, but I need to be able to gather smart people around me. And then I need to trust them that, you know, they might know something more about this, particularly our people who were, you know, doing the operation every day. When we wanted to try something new or tighten up some system, we would say, what do you think? How do we do this? This is the objective that we have. How do you think we can accomplish that? Like, you know, how can we make our customers happier? They came up with all kinds of ideas. It didn't have to come from us.
Yeah. Did you run into an experience though, where you where you maybe thought you had buy-in from a team member, and then as you got down that path, you realized, oh, wait a second, we were talking about different things, or that wasn't genuine buy-in.
That can happen with a specific team member from time to time. Mm-hmm. And then you give them the opportunity to deselect themselves.
Okay.
But you don't need to be on this team.
Yeah.
If you're not part of the team, you can leave, and that's okay.
You're making it sound so simple, Ral.
Well, you know, yeah, in retrospect, it always looks simple, right? Like that's the 2020 hindsight.
Yeah.
But sure, there was agony and angst, and, you know, we'd have team members that we needed to, you know, show the door to, and many times we waited way too long to show them the door because they were not being a team player. Sometimes they were being, you know, outright disruptive. And yeah. I remember one time where we had there was a project that we were working on that was top secret, and we couldn't let anybody outside the company know. And I heard that somebody was blabbing. Oh. And I, you know, I found out about it. And in a meeting, I just said, you're fired.
Yeah.
That's not tolerated.
Yeah.
So that's it. You're out.
Do those abrupt changes cause ripple effects through the company sometimes? Or was your culture such that if that happened, people already knew, like, we're already on board. We're bought in. So if somebody isn't on board and there are consequences, that doesn't really impact us. We're still bought in.
I think what happens is that, yes, there'll be some people who are like shocked by that kind of, you know, abrupt action. Uh-huh. And then most of people though went, you know what? This is our business too. And yeah. He was jeopardizing our business. So we're glad that you followed through. Because if we don't enforce the rules that we set, that's saying something to the whole team too, that accountability has to come with some strength behind it and some willingness to, you know, to commit, you know, and have a consequence be felt. Yeah. Otherwise, what good are the rules?
Well, and that buy-in probably came from the fact that you years before were teaching them P&Ls and balance sheets and cash flow statements and the fundamentals of the business. And they probably felt bought in from that moment forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And when the cash hit their pocket, they were really bought in.
That doesn't hurt, does it?
Yeah.
What would you say to somebody who hasn't been doing this for 45 years, maybe doesn't feel quite as experienced or confident as you are in this? What's the, you know, how do they gain that confidence? Is it just they got to experience it and get there? Or what can they do to leverage your insights without having to go through the full 45 years?
Well, you can come and learn from me for one thing, but other than that, you know, I think you have to start. You can't just think about it. You have to take some action, and you have to have faith in yourself and faith in other people as well. So this is not going to happen because you plan it all out and, you know, you've designed the bridge and you're going to build the bridge exactly this way. Things don't always happen in life and in business the way you think they ought to. So you have to be